grab some popcorn and a favorite chair. The love of movies is why we're here. Press play and don't delay. Let Phil be our guide to a cinematic day. Phil at the movies, from the silver screen to his podcast stream. Phil's covering every movie dream. Phil at the movies. Phil at the movies. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to another edition of Phil at the Movies. I'm, of course, your host, Phil Walsh, and you are listening to episode number 186 of this ongoing podcast that is, well, for the month of October at least, for the love of spooky movies. And based on the ringing phone at the start of today's episode, you probably surmised that I'm going to be talking about, yes, a horror movie, and a much anticipated one for me, Black Phone 2. This has been my most anticipated horror movie of the year. It is, of course, the sequel to The Black Phone, which came out in 2022, starring Ethan Hawke as the, as far as I'm concerned, newly cemented horror icon, The Grabber. But before I share with you my thoughts on the new film, let me do a little bit of housekeeping and news items to share, because this is actually the first episode that I have recorded in the month of October. The previous two shows were done in September, so I am recording this here on Thursday night, October 16th, and I have to say I'm a little sad because we are halfway through the month of October, my favorite month of the year, my favorite time of the year, Halloween season, spooky season, and it's going a little too fast for my taste. The month needs to slow down. Yes, we have November to look forward to and the harvest and the continuation of autumn and, of course, Thanksgiving, but the fact of the matter is this is my favorite time. This is my season. Halloween is more than just a day on the calendar. It is an entire vibe. And really from the time after Labor Day until the 31st, I am in the zone. And I'm a little sad because it really does feel like it just pedal to the metal this year in particular, but I am savoring every last moment. It's been a spectacular spooky season. Again, truly just vibe with this time of year, but it's going a little too fast for me. But I hope you all have been enjoying this time of year. Maybe you've gone apple picking, pumpkin picking, maybe gone to a haunted house or some hayride attraction, or do something that I personally love to do this time of year, which is to watch scary movies during the night, because that is really that's just such a fun little pastime this time of year in particular, because of course we are in the spookiest time of the year. So again, hope your spooky season has been going well, and it will be continuing to march on as we head towards the all-important day of October 31st. But making a quick transition, there is something that has been very frightening in the news, and frightening is really putting it mildly. Apparently, some genius, and I say that with deep sarcasm, some genius created an artificial intelligence actress, an AI actress, yes, Miss Tilly Norwood. And this creation, the creator believes that his creation should be maybe getting representation in Hollywood, that this is the next big thing. This is the next big step. And, I think gratefully and fortunately, much of Hollywood and particularly actors in general, have laughed and balked at this insidious creation, to say nothing of the fact that AI is not art, the fact that an AI actress would be created and then suggested for roles or involvement in movies. I can't even begin to wrap my head around such garbage, but that is indeed what it is, garbage. And as far as I'm concerned, garbage belongs in the trash can. And so Tilly Norwood, or whatever the hell it is not a real person. It is not an actress and should not be treated as such. And we should laugh, mock, point fingers, deride such foolish creations because, I mean, number one, the history of science fiction movies points that this is a dangerous road to go down. But putting all of that aside, the idea that something artificially created could somehow surpass the intelligent creation of a human being and what an actual actor is able to bring to the screen, it just doesn't compute. It doesn't connect. An artificial creation is just that, artificial. It will never be human. And I encourage you, if you haven't followed the story, go do a Google search and you'll find the image of this thing. And you will see, no matter how much they try, no matter how hard they try, meaning the geniuses that do this stuff for a living, they cannot surpass human ingenuity. They cannot create something better than an actual person, because at the end of the day, it's just artificial. It's a robot. It's not real. It's an inanimate object. So this stuff really gets me fired up, and I don't mean to get on a soapbox, but it's really scary stuff. I mean, we've let the AI genie out of the bottle. I'm not naive enough to think we're going to put it back in, but there has got to be some pumping of the brakes here, because the fact that someone would even make the suggestion of an AI actress, I mean, that is just bonkers, and it is stupid, and it should be called out. So I mentioned that in passing. Again, point, deride, criticize, call this stuff out, because it is utter nonsense. And like I said, it's garbage, and garbage goes in the trash. My pickup happens every Tuesday, so watch your schedule. But my goodness, it's just absolute nonsense. But on another transition, kind of on the whole, other end of the spectrum, speaking of actual talent, actual humanity, sad to see the passing of Diane Keaton last week, 79 years old. Again, I mean, there's never a good time for these things, but truly an accomplished life, an accomplished career. Be hard pressed to name one film that you would say, oh, that's the standout performance. I mean, certainly, from Annie Hall to the Godfather movies to what she, the number of films she did with Nancy Meyers, from the Father of the Bride. She was a versatile actress and truly one of the greats, who personified really 70s cinema, but even beyond that. She was a truly a figure who sort of crossed generations, and that's not something you can say of all actors, but she was definitely a special talent, and certainly left behind an amazing body of work that will stand the test of time, and was just a gifted actress, to say the very least. And certainly just a sad passing, because it really does sort of mark again the another end to an era of cinema that is just part of the history books now. You figure this year we lost the great Gene Hackman, and that was an unexpected expected loss. And, you know, we're losing the icons and the figures of our past, but we have their movies, we have their long film resumes and career to look back on, and that will be celebrated and remembered long after we all are gone. So that is something definitely noteworthy, but was sad to see that she passed away. Another point to mention, kind of, I'm all over the place today, but as I said, I'm trying to catch up on a number of different things. I saw that Jason Blum of Blumhouse, who of course is responsible for a number of popular horror films, and notably behind the Black Phone movies, which of course we'll be talking about the sequel in just a few moments. But he made some news recently where he said that he would love to do a Nightmare on Elm Street movie. Frankly, he said he would like to do Friday the 13th. Those have been his white whales, so to speak. He, of course, revitalized the Halloween franchise with David Gordon Green's trilogy from 2018 to 2022. But he has his sights set on bringing Freddy back to the big screen. And frankly, I think that's a perfect segue to talk about what today's movie is, because The Black Phone 2 is by far, and I mean this with all sincerity in the best possible way, it is the closest thing that we're going to get to a Nightmare on Elm Street in this modern era. This is the closest I have seen a Freddy Krueger inspiration, if you will, or homage since the original Nightmare on Elm Street. So, you know, there's been a number of Freddy Krueger films. I frankly find all of them to be inferior to the 1984 original. But The Black Phone 2 really does a good job at honoring the history of the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise in a way that, frankly, I think all of the sequels that came after 1984 failed to accomplish. So that is my setup for today's topic, Black Phone 2. I hope you enjoy the review. So just do a little bit of setup. The Black Phone was released in 2022, so 3 years ago now. And the film was actually based on a short story by Joe Hill. In the film, Finn Blake, played by Mason Thames, is kidnapped by the notorious child abductor known as the Grabber, played by Ethan Hawke. And he is kept captive in the Grabber's basement, where there is a black phone on the wall that is disconnected. But the phone rings, and only Finney can hear the phone ringing. And when he answers it, he hears the voices of the souls that the Grabber has taken and killed over his many years. And together, they work with Finney to help him fight back and escape the clutches of the Grabber. Sort of voices from beyond working together with Finney, who was in the real world, to form a plan and fight back against this monster. Of course, Finney is successful. He defeats and kills the Grabber and is able to be reunited with his sister Gwen and father. So now, flash forward 4 years. It's 1982, and Finney is struggling to come to terms with the trauma of the events he experienced. Even though the Grabber is dead, his presence looms large over the film. He is the unseen boogeyman that is taunting Finney to the present day. He gets into fights. He's sort of throwing his life away, smoking marijuana, just sort of burying his pain and trying to forget the hell he endured while being in that basement. He's hearing ringing phones, even ones that are disconnected. It's truly an examination of a person struggling to cope with a traumatic event and not being able to move forward with their life. At the same time, his sister Gwen, played by Madeline McGraw, As established in the previous film, she has psychic abilities and is able to see things before they happen. She plays an instrumental role in the first film, helping the police discover where the grabber is keeping the bodies of his victims. We also learn in the first film that their mother, Hope, also had similar psychic abilities, but it ultimately led to her taking her own life years before the events of the first film. Well, now again, flash forward to the present day. Gwen is starting to have these terrifying nightmares, and they're recurring time and again. She's sleepwalking, and she keeps seeing images of these mutilated children at a youth camp in the Rocky Mountains. And it sort of keeps coming at her, keeps calling to her, and she discovers that there is a connection between the youth camp and her dreams. And they discover that their mother, in fact, worked at this youth camp years ago. And so under the pretext of pretending to be a counselors in training, they go up to this youth camp with the intention of trying to uncover the mystery of what happened to these three lost children. Of course, once they arrive, they discover that maybe their being there is not an accident, but instead a twist of fate. And they discover that the grabber himself worked at this youth camp years ago. And this leads to a horrifying realization that this boogeyman, while dead in the physical sense, is beginning to stalk and haunt the dreams of the psychic Gwen. And as she struggles to try and locate the lost bodies of these three children, the grabber is becoming more powerful and proving that there might even be a fate worse than death. All right, so let me say, as I started at the beginning, this is the closest we are going to get to a Nightmare on Elm Street film in the modern age, short of them actually making a new film with Freddy Krueger. This is a Nightmare on Ice, and I'm not saying that tongue-in-cheek. The use of a frozen lake is a prominent setting in this film, and it really plays into the whole visage of the grabber and his modus operandi for the film. I found the dream sequences in this movie to be as terrifying and unsettling as what was done in the original film of A Nightmare on Elm Street. This is a love letter to what Wes Craven did in that first film, and I'd even argue it is more successful than any of the sequels starring Freddy Krueger, with maybe the exception of A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, but we're not going to get into the Nightmare series today. I'm just sort of using it as a reference point, because the film leans heavily into that Nightmare on Elm Street vibe to create a monster that is seemingly unstoppable. And there are moments in this film where Gwen is either sleepwalking or asleep in her bed, and she's being confronted with these visions of the dead children and then the arrival of the grabber at the same time. And it creates this terrifying dichotomy where she is being attacked and tortured by this monster in the dream world, and everyone outside in the real world is watching the horror play out. It's masterfully done. And again, as I said, Scott Derrickson is really paying homage to what Wes Craven was able to do in the Nightmare on Elm Street movie. And it's here for a modern context, and it is frightening. It is really terrifying and unsettling. I found this film to be the case where the grabber, played by Ethan Hawke menacingly and perfectly once again, really has become a modern age horror icon in a vacuum, if you will, post Ghostface. Some might argue Art the Clown has filled that void, but I really think the grabber is one in the running for a modern horror icon. He is terrifying. He's creepy. Again, you've got an unsettling mask. You've got a whole MO, which is deeply troubling. And Ethan Hawke, who is a fantastic actor, never phones it in, no pun intended. He really dials it up to 11 and creates a monster that is even more terrifying and more menacing and more disturbing than what we saw even in the first film. If the first film was more of a straightforward stalker, abductor, killer, this is the Nightmare Man. This is a boogeyman personified, and it really does raise the level, if you will, of the Grabber from just another guy in a mask to a truly terrifying icon that you could put alongside Freddy Krueger, Jason, and of course Michael Myers. But all that said, it really is a film that leans into that nightmare setting in order to drive its point home. The film is not as streamlined and straightforward necessarily as the original film. The original film, despite the supernatural elements of Gwen's psychic abilities and the ringing of the black phone and the voices from beyond, it still does play like a survival movie in a lot of ways. It's much more grounded, if you will, in reality, whereas this one, it really does take license and leans more into the horror fantasy realm, which I have to say, for a sequel, it was a really bold and I think largely successful way to go, because based on how the last film ended, the Grabber was dead. Finn killed him, and short of them retconning that movie or doing a prequel, you weren't going to have a flesh and blood killer again. So I have to give them major props for sort of leaning into the supernatural elements of the first film and really cranking it up a couple notches, because this one really does lean into that supernatural horror element. You think of films like The Conjuring, for example. There is definitely that kind of influence in the way that the Grabber is able to exist. And, you know, you could say, well, you know, he's only there in the dream world, so therefore he's not that frightening. But the way the story is constructed and the fact that they're in this campground in the middle of a snowstorm, they're cut off from civilization, adds to the intensity and the stakes, if you will, where you really feel like, oh my God, maybe they are going to be all taken out here. And the way the film intercuts reality and the dream world is really well done. There's a way that the cinematography shifts to kind of let you know that things are in the dreamscape versus here in our world. And it kind of feels like a grainy 70s film when that happens, which just sort of adds to the overall aesthetic and zeal of this monster. Mason Thames and Madeline McGraw, they're both back again as Finn and Gwen, respectively. And, I mean, they really deliver home runs here. I mean, Finn is the heart and soul of the first film. Gwen is much more in a supporting role. This film is much more of Gwen's story, but I never felt that, like, Finny took a back seat or anything. I thought they were both really on equal footing, but, you know, as was the case with Ethan Hawke, they're not phoning in it either. And there are some real emotional moments in this film, particularly as they're trying to come to terms with what happened. And even though this is, you know, it's a horror movie and there's supernatural elements, there is that element of realism and humanity that shines through with it. Particularly, there's a scene where Finn and Gwen and their father are sort of like having a heart to heart and coming to terms with everything that has happened. And the acting is just like, you almost forget you're watching a horror movie. Like it could just be a straightforward drama. I mean, it's just such a raw beautiful set, a trio of performances. But I mean, again, that is sort of the beauty of a horror movie. You can get so many different elements and genres all rolled into one. But Thames and McGraw, they really hit it out of the park with this film. And there's a moment at the end, and I won't spoil it because I really want to try to avoid going into too many spoilers, because the film, of course, just opens. By the time you're listening to this, it will have opened. But there's a scene at the end where Madeline McGraw, it packs an emotional punch. And again, she's firing on all cylinders throughout the film. And like I said, she really is the emotional center and the driving force for the narrative. But at the very end of it, she delivers a moment that is just, I thought I had tears in my eyes just watching it. It's just so affecting and beautifully done. And I mean, they both have already established themselves as rising actors, and I feel like this one really puts their talents on full display. I have to say, I was really surprised at how sentimental and emotional the film ended up being. Again, despite this being a horror movie, despite there being terror and a monster invading the dreams and torturing people and wielding an axe, there's a lot of heart and sentimentality to this film, and it really gets to this theme of family and unity and togetherness and overcoming an adversity, despite how traumatic or troubling it may have been. And it's not like some horror films where it feels spoon-fed or force-fed in a way. This felt very natural and in keeping in the world. And I mentioned that point earlier about the realism. It makes complete sense that this kid, Finn, would be just sort of struggling, going through day-to-day, smoking weed, getting into fights, not dealing with his anger or dealing with his fear. You imagine in a situation where events happen in today's world, I mean, the kid would be rolled into therapy and probably be bubble wrapped, which, I mean, I guess we could argue whether that's always the right approach either. But it really does feel like this would have been the early 1980s, where it's like, okay, hey, you survived, dust it off and get on with your life. And this film really comes to terms with that, as it also does with Gwen's own psychic abilities, which are really just introduced in the first film. And because she's a small child, they're not really given enough chance to marinate and truly develop. Whereas here, we get to see her reckoning with the fact that she feels cursed and feels like she has all this power and knowledge and doesn't know what to do with it, but it ultimately comes to use and to good use in this film in particular. And there's a rather interesting twist that is established, which sort of, in a way, I won't say it retcons, but it definitely puts into perspective a storyline that was established in the first film, particularly with Finn and Gwen's mother, who, as I mentioned, had psychic abilities like Gwen, but ultimately led to her taking her own life, or so we were told in the first film. But this one really does lean into uncovering more about Gwen's powers and their mother's abilities, and it all ties together interestingly with a connection vis-a-vis the Grabber, which I was actually surprised that they went in that direction. But it's a twist that I think actually kind of, it works, and it doesn't feel forced or contrived in a way. Everything here, I have to say, really does work and work well. And I think that goes back to the fact that they took the bold swing of leaning into the supernatural elements here. Again, I imagine if this movie was made 40 years ago, you just would have found a way to bring the Grabber back to life in physical form and had him run around town going after Finny. And that's fine. We've seen that before. But this was different because it allowed the Grabber to become a whole different kind of threat. And it really made for a sense of menace and terror. And I will say this one spoiler, so step away from the podcast if you haven't seen the film yet, but there is a choice made in this movie where none of the principal characters, even the supporting characters, even the characters you think might be set up to be cannon fodder, none of them die. None of them die. The only characters that are dead in this film were already dead. And I think that was a rather interesting choice, particularly for a horror movie, a horror movie that kind of leans into that not quite slasher element, but definitely more of a thriller, a stalking vibe, particularly from the first film. I thought that was a really unique choice. And it, again, it works. It works. I think that's because the film leans so heavily into Nightmare on Elm Street vibes, where you can kind of get away with, if you will, pardon the expression, a low body count. Because I know that's sort of the expectation when you go to see these films sometimes. Who's going to make it out alive? Who makes it to the final reel? And I thought that was a really interesting choice, because it's not the conventional wisdom when it comes to any horror film, or in particularly a sequel, where usually it's bloodier, it's meaner and nastier and all that. And this is certainly bloodier in a lot of ways than the first film, and it is edgier. But the choices made here are bold. And, you know, the more I think about it, again, it's only been a few hours since I left the theater, but I'm really digging this sequel. I think it is a real solid entry, and I don't know if this is going to be it. I mean, I won't get into the ending because, again, I won't spoil everything, but, I mean, there's a sense of closure with this film. I think the underlying theme of coming to terms with who you are, with trauma, with pain, with the past, all of that is wrapped up neatly in this film. And I think whereas the first film definitely wrapped everything up vis-a-vis the story, there were elements, particularly with regards to Gwen's psychic abilities and her connection with her mother, that were sort of left hanging. And the sequel addresses those points and really ties everything together in a nice, neat little bow. So I honestly felt very satisfied by the conclusion of this film. I won't say that the film surpasses the original. It doesn't eclipse it. The Black Phone is still superior, but that doesn't diminish Black Phone 2, because as far as sequels go, and I have certainly made my my points on horror sequels over the years, it's really risky business, because a lot of times they are inferior cash grabs. They rehash elements from the original, or in some rare cases, they take such out of left field swings for the fences that, I mean, we're left leaving and wondering what the hell just happened. This is a case where, while the film does not surpass the creepiness and just sort of the originality, if you will, of the first film, this one is bold enough to take some swings. And there's a creative zeal that allows it to stand on its own, where, yes, it does have the setup from the original, but it goes in a direction that is unconventional. And in a world where we've had so many safe, play it cautious sequels, it's refreshing, particularly with a horror movie, to see one really go for something bold and radical that honors the elements of the original, but then goes in a completely new direction. So I have to say, I really enjoyed this film a great deal. I said on Twitter, and I'll say it here, don't ignore the call. Don't send it to voicemail. Answer Black Phone 2, because it will be worth your time. I'm giving this film 4 stars, and it as far as being one of my most anticipated horror films of the year, you know, scratch that, my most anticipated horror film of the year, it really lived up to the hype and delivered something that was both utterly terrifying and surprisingly emotional. Having two younger sisters, I really appreciated the brother-sister connection between Finney and Gwen, and they really together are the heart and soul of this movie. And if you can have that kind of sentimentality and warmth in a horror movie, as far as I'm concerned, you really have done your trick, because a horror movie should be more than just scares and terror. There should be characters that you actually care about at the end of it. And that was the case with the first film, and it's even more so the case with this film. So, as I said before, answer the call. You will be glad you did, especially if you loved the first film. And even if you didn't see the first one, but you're looking just for a good, scary movie, this one is going to check all those boxes for you. So there we have it, The Black Phone 2. Ran a little bit longer on today's episode, but wanted to put together my thoughts as best I could, just having seen the movie a few short hours ago. But certainly would be curious to know your thoughts. Let me know down on the comments if you're listening to this episode on YouTube, or certainly you can stalk me in the best possible way on social media, Twitter, etc., and let me know your thoughts there. Where does this film rank compared to the original film? I certainly would be glad, interested to see where people's thoughts and takes lie after they've seen the film. But that does it for me today, everybody. Want to thank you, as always, for tuning in to today's show. Appreciate your love and support. Next week, I will be joined by my buddy Anthony DiPuzzo from the Never Split Up podcast. We're going to be talking Halloween Ends 3 years later, the much discussed, much maligned third entry in the David Gordon Green trilogy. And then 2 weeks from now, what a perfect way to cap off Halloween, which happens to fall on a Friday, so I figured had to go out all big this year. I'll be joined by my buddies Chris Evans and Anthony Caruso. Both have been on the show a number of times, both together and separately. And for that episode, that Halloween-centric episode, going to be ranking the Halloween franchise. And fair warning, everybody, it is a four-hour-long episode. Yes, you heard that correct. We really get into the details of the Halloween franchise, and frankly, it was a surprising ranking. I'll say that for myself, that turned out quite differently than I even anticipated going into the episode. But we had a lot of fun. And so that'll be coming up over the next 2 weeks before the end of October. So all Halloween, all the time for the next 2 weeks. So look forward to that, everybody. But on that note, thank you again. I'll be back next week, where we'll do this all over again for the love of movies. Phil's covering every movie dream. Phil at the movies makes every movie.